Okay, well, thank you very much for the invitation. Oh, I'm going to see. Is that helping? Yeah, good to use this. Okay. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak. I actually feel quite new to dyslexia research, actually, because I started off looking at autism in particular. But I became to realise that it's actually by studying both autism and dyslexia together, we can actually get some very interesting insights about how similar or how different those two developmental conditions might be. Do I have to keep holding this down? Do I have to keep... I'm not sure if I have... Because now it's not working, is it?
It doesn't make a massive difference.
Doesn't... Can you hear me okay without it? If I project well?
That's okay.
I think it's more that I have to hold it down, so I'm not sure that's going to... Is that working?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, we'll see. tell me if it stops working. Okay, so I'm going to start off by giving you some background into visual processing in dyslexia in terms of the history and why it might be worth looking at. And then I'm going to give you some kind of brief background into visual processing in autism. And that will set the scene for telling you about a study that we have recently done. And then I'm going to finish on something a little bit different, which is about setting priorities for future dyslexia research. And I'm hoping to leave plenty of time for questions at the end. Does that sound okay? So let's start off with our kind of potted history of visual processing in dyslexia to start off with. So why did I first become interested in visual processing in dyslexia? Well, to read, we clearly need to map what we see, so you know the words on the page, to language. And so it's maybe not surprising that kind of early on, reading difficulties were thought to be attributed to differences in the visual system. So in fact, the term dyslexia was first used in 1887 by a German ophthalmologist, so this is someone who studies vision. And around the same time, the term congenital word blindness became used by various medical professionals, including ophthalmologists. William Pringle Morgan was a GP who reported on a 14-year-old boy called Percy. And he noted, he seems to have no power of preserving and storing up the visual impression produced by words. Hence, the words, though seen, have no significance for him. His eyes are normal, his eyesight is good. So what's clear from this quote is the idea that difficulties with reading words and word blindness is not associated with kind of low-level problems with the eyes. So the eyes are functioning normally, but difficulties might arise in how the brain processes that visual information. And this suggestion is that it might primarily be a problem with visual memory for words. So a little bit later, Samuel T. Orton thought that dyslexia was caused by differences in how the two halves of the brain function when processing visual information. And he suggested that this could lead to letter and word reversals. Now, this account is no longer thought to be true. And of course, letter reversals are only a sort of not the one and only symptom of dyslexia. But his ideas paved the way for investigations into the visual system in dyslexia. Fast forward another 50 years or so, and William Lovegrove came up with some ideas about visual processing in dyslexia that remain influential now. So compared to early explanations of word blindness, this theory focuses on the visual system more generally. So to explain this account, I'm going to give you a bit of an introduction into how the brain is structured. So visual information comes into the eye, and it's transferred via the optic nerve. Let me see if I can get my door. So it comes into the information comes into the eye, and then it's transferred along the optic nerve to this structure in the middle of the brain called the lateral geniculate nucleus. And from there, it goes to the primary visual cortex, which is at the back of the head. And then the information goes to other regions in the brain. But there are two parallel pathways that are specialised for different things. So one is the magnocellular or dorsal stream, which is often dubbed the where pathway, because it's for working out where things are. And this also includes working out how things move from one place to another. So it's particularly specialised for processing dynamic information, things that change very quickly. And then you also have the parvocellular or ventral stream, which is often called the what pathway. And instead, this one is involved more in kind of recognising objects, reading text, perceiving colours and patterns. Now, the magnocellular theory of dyslexia proposes that dyslexia is characterised by difficulties related to the magnocellular or dorsal stream pathway. While difficulties in the dorsal or magnocellular system could affect a range of abilities, I'm going to focus on how we perceive motion information, as this is a really important aspect that relies on the dorsal or magnocellular system. Why is it important? Well, working out the speed and direction that things move in is important for making sense and interacting with the world around us. We need to be able to work out the speed and direction that things are going in order to be able to catch things, to cross a road. And sometimes you have, say, lots of different things, like birds, that are all moving in slightly different directions. And to be able to make sense of them, you need to kind of combine all of the information together of them, kind of where's the overall direction of the flock of birds. So if dyslexic children process motion differently, this could actually have a really big effect on how they perceive the world and how they interact with it. So how do we measure this motion processing ability in a controlled way so we can really work out exactly how well children can process motion? The most commonly used task is the motion coherence task, which I'm showing you here. So what you have is there's a proportion of dots that all move in the same direction, and then the rest of them move in completely random directions. So anyone want to tell me which way the overall direction is going on this example? Down, yeah, perfect. So this is because the majority of the dots are going downwards and then the rest are going completely randomly. And the task becomes harder and harder as you reduce the amount of dots that are going in the same direction. So at some point, you won't be able to work out the overall direction because most of them are going in random directions. And people with dyslexia have been shown to need more dots to be moving in the same direction in order to see the overall whole than people without dyslexia. And this has been taken of evidence for difficulties in the magnocellular system. But there are also other accounts. So one is that actually it's not necessarily about difficulties processing the motion, but it could be that people with dyslexia have difficulties kind of ignoring those ones that are all going in random directions. They sort of struggle to filter them out. So that's like another account. So before I go into our study, I'd like to quickly talk about whether atypical motion processing might be causally related to dyslexia. So could it be that differences in the brain system responsible for motion processing actually lead to children's difficulties with reading and spelling? Well, some people would say yes, that atypical motion processing actually causes the reading difficulties that characterise dyslexia. And one piece of evidence for this is because children who go on to develop dyslexia have been shown to have difficulties with processing motion even before they start learning to read, which suggests that those difficulties in motion processing might come before reading difficulties. Now, why could this be the case? Well, it could be that difficulties in the magnocellular dorsal system, which is particularly involved in perceiving rapidly changing things, dynamic information, that could also lead to difficulties with auditory phonological processing. So potentially that could then also lead to reading difficulties. There have also been some intervention studies which show that you can train the magnocellular dorsal system, for example, by giving participants loads of motion processing tasks, and that that will actually improve their reading. But it's not a simple story, as things generally are never simple. So there have actually been studies showing that the relationship between magnocellular dorsal functioning and reading is actually not very strong. So if you know someone's sort of motion processing ability, you won't necessarily be able to predict very well how good they can read. And there's also been a study which shows that actually the majority of people with dyslexia don't have difficulties processing motion. So it could only be about a third of those with dyslexia who actually have difficulties here. And finally, there's been a study which almost argues the one above, which shows that you can train, that if you train people's reading, so you've intervened with people's reading, that you will then improve their motion processing ability. So it's a bit of a complicated picture. The jury is really kind of well and truly out on this one. And resolving this debate would help us to think about interventions. But I think from my perspective, even if there isn't a causal relationship, differences in visual tasks can tell us how people with dyslexia's brains work differently. And also, difficulties processing motion could be lead to difficulties with other aspects of life. So, for example, interacting with the world around us, moving eyes, moving bodies, and things like that. So where does autism come into this? Well, autism is another developmental condition like dyslexia, but it has quite a different profile. So to get a diagnosis of autism, people have to present with both differences in social communication and interaction, as well as non-social symptoms, including repetitive, restricted behaviours and interests. And it's in this last class of non-social symptoms, which now includes sensory processing differences. And sensory differences are found for all modalities, not just vision. So vision is just kind of one aspect of this. Sensory symptoms can include both over-responding to sensory information. So, for example, some autistic people are very sensitive to flickering or fluorescent lights, for example. But it can also include under-responding. So this could be maybe autistic people not always noticing sounds, for example. And then there's sensory seeking, which involves seeking out sensory stimulation. And that could be maybe someone flickering their hands in front of their eyes and watching the visual stimulation that creates. In terms of visual processing, it's been proposed that autistic people have a different perceptual style. And that is that they tend to focus on sort of small details rather than the overall whole. But it's also been proposed that in autism, the magnocellular dorsal stream might be developing atypically, as it does in dyslexia. And similarly to those with dyslexia, autistic people also have difficulties in this kind of task. So they also can struggle to see the overall motion in this sort of task. So both autistic and dyslexic people show differences in how they process motion information, but is it for the same reasons? Are autistic and dyslexic people affected in the same way? If so, that might suggest that there's just a sort of general marker of a brain that's developing differently. Or is it that the conditions are affected differently, so it actually tells us something specific about those conditions? So far, not many studies have actually directly compared the two conditions, so it's hard to tell. And so this is what this current piece of work was aiming to tell us. So one way in which people with dyslexia and people with autism could differ is in the stage of processing that is affected. And this is because when we decide which direction something is going in, there are actually many different stages of processing involved. So for example, if you're showing this video and you're asked to work out whether the dots are overall moving up or down, and then to press a button to say whether the motion is up or down, you first of all have to do some basic sensory processing. So you have to kind of work out what you're looking at. You have to process those white dots on the black background. And then as what you're seeing is continually being updated, you have to kind of accumulate all the evidence together to work out what direction it's going in. You can't do it immediately. You have to look for a while and combine what you're seeing now with what you've already seen. And then when you think that you've got enough information to make your decision, you can commit to your decision, and then you need to decide which button to press, like whether you're going to say it's up or down. So if dyslexic and autistic children struggle in this kind of task, then there are many different reasons why this could be the case. So they might have difficulties sort of initially seeing and encoding the white dots on the black background. They could have difficulties combining the information together and accumulating the evidence, or they might have differences in their decision-making strategies. So what I mean by this is that dyslexic people may need more information until they're happy to make a decision. So they might be a little bit more cautious. Or, alternatively, they could be a bit riskier and they might emphasise speed over accuracy. Or there could be differences in how they make their responses and how they press buttons. Or there could be differences in all of those stages all at the same time. So in this study, we're trying to look at which stages of processing are affected in dyslexia and to see whether that might also be the same or different stages as those affected in autism. So let's go into our study and how we did this. So there are two techniques that we can use to tell us about which processing stages are affected in dyslexia and autism, which we used in this project. The first one is mathematical modelling. So here what we do is we take information about how many trials a child can answer correctly, so how accurate they are, as well as how fast they make those decisions, and then we compare it with a mathematical model with different processing stages. And then we then estimate how long each of those processing stages took. The second technique is EEG, or electroencephalography. Now, the brain is made up of neurons, which send messages to each other through electrical changes. And if you have lots of neurons firing together at the same time, you can listen into those changes in electrical activity from the scalp using this technique. So you can see changes in the brain activity that are linked to things that you might be presenting to people with dyslexia. So you can show them something on a screen and see how the brain activity changes as you show that thing on the screen. And just want to sort of stress, as I do to my participants, that this is a completely sort of safe method. Nothing comes out of the sensors, okay? So it's only you're reading information from the sensors, you're not sending anything into the brain. So that means that we're not changing children's brain activity, which some parents have said that they're a bit disappointed about. And we also like to make children aware that we're not able to read their mind, right? It's just not that good. So, it's a very well accepted technique, and you basically just put this stretchy cap on children's heads, and then you can read their brain activity whilst they're doing tasks. And when we present kind of motion processing tasks like this to children, we need to present the task lots and lots of times. There's lots of repetitions, so we get a good idea of how accurate they are and also how quickly they can do it, which is very boring. So we need to be a bit creative in how we make these tasks like fun for children to keep them engaged. So we made this game that was set in a zoo for insects called Insect Land, and children were given a set of animations where they were told that they would see some dots which are actually fireflies in viewing boxes. And then they were told that those fireflies would start escaping out of the boxes, and they had to work out which direction those fireflies were going in so that the zookeeper could then fix the boxes and save the fireflies. And they were asked to go as quickly and accurately as possible so that they could save as many fireflies as they could. So it started off with they just had to look at a little dot on the screen to make sure they're all paying attention and looking in the same place. And then it starts off with the fireflies going in random directions all over the place. And then there's a little beep, and the fireflies start moving together, either to the left or right, a proportion of them. And it's at this point that the children are asked to say, does it go to the left or right? And they're asked to press a button as quickly and accurately as possible. And then the information is just presented for a little bit longer on the screen until it moves on to the next trial. And we had easy and difficult examples. And we also had two different tasks. So, and in these two different tasks, we just slightly changed the way that the dots moved. So the first task was a standard motion coherence task. So this is what I've already shown you. There's a proportion of the dots which move left or right, and then the rest are completely random. And I've highlighted the red dots here, but that wasn't shown to the participants, right? So they couldn't see that red. It's just for you to see that some of them are going in the same direction. We then added a slightly different task where we only have one set of dots, but they vary from each other slightly, and the average direction is leftwards or rightwards. And the reason that we added this task was because if the main difficulty that people with dyslexia have is filtering out those ones that are going in random directions, then they should have difficulties in the motion coherence task only, but not in the motion integration task, where they can just combine everything together. So that's the reason. And we split the game up into 10 levels so that children could have breaks. And at the end of each level, they could put a stamp in their this record card so that they could just kind of keep a track of how they were doing and sort of stay motivated. And they got points as they went. So they were trying to beat their own scores. We saw 50 children with a dyslexia diagnosis and 50 typically developing children who were aged between 6 and 14 years. So in this table, I'm showing you the average for each group and then the range. And you'll see that the minimum age of the children with dyslexia is a little bit higher, which just reflects the fact that children tend to get a dyslexia diagnosis at a certain age. And we had a relatively even number of girls and boys. All of the children were what we'd call cognitively able, so their IQ scores were above 70, so they did not have intellectual impairments. But you can see that the children with dyslexia did have slightly lower IQ scores overall than the typically developing children. We measured children's non-word reading ability using the TOWRI test of word reading efficiency, and we measured their spelling ability with the Veschler individual achievement test subtest. And then we combined those two measures to get a composite score of reading and spelling ability. So we only included children in our dyslexia group if they scored, had a composite of 89 or below, the standard score. And we only included children in our typically developing group if they had a score of 89 or above. So you can see that obviously those scores are very different, as you would expect. And we also saw 50 autistic children within the same age ranges to form a kind of an extra comparison group. So first of all, I'm going to show you how accurately and how fast the dyslexic children performed in this task compared to typically developing children. So here I'm showing you how accurate children were in each group. For the typically developing children in grey and then the dyslexic children in blue. So this is the proportion of trials where children correctly worked out the direction, where one means that they got all of the questions correct. So this top figure is showing you how they did in the motion coherence task, and then the bottom is this other motion integration task. For difficult goes on the left, and then easy trials on the right. And the black dot there shows you the average performance in each group, and the coloured splodges basically show you how much variability there is in each group. So the widest point of the splodge basically tells you how most children in each group did. So you can see that the widest point is generally over 0.9. So most children got 90% or more of the trials correct. And you can see that some children struggled a lot more. So you can see these tails go from just over 50% correct. So the children with dyslexia are a little bit less accurate than the typically developing children overall. That's particularly in this second task, the motion integration one, and less so in this one. So a little bit less accurate. And now I'm showing you the median response time, so how quickly they made these decisions. And you can see again that there's lots of overlap between the groups, so it's not a massive difference between the two groups, but the children with dyslexia are slightly slower in both tasks, so their mean is just slightly longer. So dyslexic children are slightly slower and less accurate than typical children when doing these motion processing tasks. So when we did our mathematical modelling, what we found was that this basically related to children with dyslexia being slower to extract the motion information from the displays and make their decision. So that they're sort of less sensitive to the motion information in the displays. They're not accumulating that information as quickly as the children without dyslexia. But they didn't seem to show any differences in how they actually made those decisions once they'd got the information. And interestingly, this wasn't the same pattern as in autistic children. So instead, the autistic children, who are shown in orange, they actually performed very similarly to the typical children, both in terms of their accuracy and the speed of their responses. And then when we ran the mathematical model, we didn't find any clear differences in processing stages between the typical and autistic children. So this suggests that there's the difference that is specific to dyslexia, not found in autism. So now let's have a look at the brain activity from the EEG. So these diagrams show a map of the sensors on the EEG net, imagine you're looking down from the top of the head. So the eyes would be here, and this is the nose, and these would be chin straps going underneath the chin. So yeah, it's a bit like you're looking down on this person here, and just got a map of those different sensors. Now there are 128 sensors, and these are all the little circles that are shown on the maps, and then the lines between them are the elastic bits of the net. Now there's a massive amount of data here, because we took readings from each sensor 500 times each second, and each recording would probably last around half an hour, and we have 128 different sensors for each participant, and we have 100 participants. So there's a lot of data. So what we do is we need to kind of find a way of simplifying this so we can actually interpret it. So what we do is we actually found these two kind of components which basically explain the data in the best way. So they kind of pick up patterns that are found across participants, across trials. And the two main components we found, one of them was I'm going to call it the visual processing component, because it has maximal activity at the back of the head over areas like the visual cortex. And this has been linked to motion processing in the past. Then we also have another component which has maximal activity, so the red bit, on the top of the head. And this is in previous research being linked to kind of decision-making processes, how well you can make a decision. So I'm going to look first at the visual processing component, which has maximal activity at the back of the head. So what I'm showing you here is how the activity in these areas, shown on the map, vary across time for typically developing children in grey, dyslexic children in blue, and then autistic children in orange. And the dark line in the middle of each of those squiggly lines is the average activity for each group, and then the shaded region around it gives you an idea of how variable the children were in each group. This vertical line here, just where it says 0 milliseconds, that's the point at which the dots started to move in the same direction. And we expected to see that, as we do here, that you get these patterns of sort of like peaks and troughs after you see the dots starting to move in a certain direction. We expected that we might see differences between the groups here, this like little dip here, but actually we didn't. So we only found differences between the groups actually at much later processing stages. So we only found differences around here, which is more like kind of 400 milliseconds after they start seeing things start to move in a certain direction. And this is for both autistic and dyslexic children. They have higher amplitudes here than the typically developing children do. So they both seem to be affected in a similar way. And interestingly, this difference was only found for the motion coherence task, where they had to kind of filter out those ones that were going in random directions, but not in the task where they could just combine everything together. So we suggest that this reflects difficulties sort of filtering out visual noise for both the autistic and the dyslexic children. So now I'm showing you the decision-making component, and this one looks quite different. So here what you find is that, you know, in the middle of the senses, in the middle of the head, you seem to find this sort of gradual ramping up of activity until people make a response. So now 0 milliseconds is when people were making their responses, pressing the button. And you see this kind of increase of activity until people make their response. And this is, in previous research, been linked to that process of being able to combine information together in order to be able to make a decision. And we found here that this, this slope was shallower in people with dyslexia. So that their brain activity was sort of ramping up more shallowly than those without dyslexia. And this actually related to the mathematical model that we got. So when we said that, that the children with dyslexia were sort of slower at combining information and making their decisions, this actually related to their EEG activity. And I'm just again going to show you the autistic children again here, who are now in orange. And so the autistic children also differ kind of around the time of the response from typical children. But remember that the autistic children didn't show any differences in their behaviour and also in their mathematical model. So there's a slightly different relationship between the behaviour and the EEG in the autistic children compared to how it is in the children with dyslexia. So to summarise what we've found, starting with the dyslexia. So in our emotion processing tasks, dyslexic children were overall slightly slower than typically developing children who didn't have any developmental conditions, and they made slightly more errors. But there is a lot of variability, and there's also a lot of overlap between those groups. Our mathematical model suggested that the differences in response time and accuracy that we see are due to children with dyslexia being less sensitive to motion information. They are less able, or they're slower, to extract the evidence that they need to then make their decisions. The children with dyslexia also differ from the typical children in their brain responses during the tasks. We find that the early kind of sensory responses to motion information are unaffected, but we find differences in later processing stages that seem to be linked to ignoring visual noise, so ignoring distractors, and making decisions and responses. As we also saw, children with autism, we can kind of compare across those two conditions, and we can say that we find both similarities and differences in how they process visual motion. So for example, some aspects of the EEG activity were similar between autism and dyslexia, but there are also differences, as autistic children actually perform very similarly in terms of their accuracy and response times as the typical children. So this suggests that there are areas of overlap between autism and dyslexia in terms of how they process visual information, but that there are also areas of divergence. And overall, it seems that motion processing is more affected in children with dyslexia than it is in children with autism. And this is important for understanding the role that atypical visual processing plays in these two conditions. So maybe the shared aspects that are seen maybe reflect just a brain that's developing a bit differently, whereas there could be those differences for dyslexia, could be something more specific to reading ability, for example. But we still need to work out why there's so much variability between children. Why are children so different in how they do these tasks? So to summarise, I want to say that dyslexic children do, on average, process visual information differently than typical children. And I've shown this through our study of visual motion processing, where dyslexic children show a reduced sensitivity to visual motion on average. It seems that dyslexic children are picking up the motion information more slowly, and that they might have difficulties ignoring visual noise. And we found brain-based markers of these differences in the EEG. In terms of what does this all mean? Well, first it shows that it is not just reading that is affected in dyslexia. So there are also differences in visual processing tasks that don't even involve letters. But there are considerable individual differences. So not all dyslexic children have difficulties processing visual motion. And this is one reason why I don't think that visual processing differences are causal to dyslexia, but differences in motion processing could be important in day-to-day tasks. And these differences do tell us something about how the brain is wired differently in at least some individuals with dyslexia. More work is now needed to understand what effects these things have on everyday life. So in particular, we need to work out whether the slow picking up of information is found only for motion tasks, or whether it is also shown for other kinds of tasks as well. And it would be really helpful to know how other skills, like processing speed and general cognitive ability, might relate to decision-making and reading abilities. And finally, we might wonder whether it is possible to train up decision-making in these kinds of tasks in order to improve reading ability. And I remain sceptical about this, but I'm just saying it because some researchers do think that this is a possibility. And there's just a little link to a write-up of our study there if you'd like to read more. Okay, now just to finish, I'm going to just shift gears slightly to a study where we've been trying to find out about what the dyslexia community would like to be researched in the future. And the reason for this is that there is no, to date, there is no research that has actually looked at what the dyslexia community would like to be researched. And therefore, the research that is currently being done may not actually align with the dyslexia community's priorities, which could mean that it's not really very well placed to make an impact on the community and to actually serve the community that it's meant to serve. So what we did was we started off by collating information about all of the dyslexia research projects done in the UK that have got funding over the last sort of 20 years or so, and then we've put those projects into different categories. And we found that UK dyslexia research overwhelmingly focuses on biological and brain-based differences in those with dyslexia, as well as differences in cognition. And we then did some focus groups with adults with dyslexia and parents or carers of people with dyslexia. And we found that they really all said that we needed to make sure there was more research in other areas, not just biology, brain and cognition, but also things like assessing the effectiveness of services as well as exploring societal issues. So we're about to launch a survey in the next month or so where we would like to get further views from people with dyslexia about what should be researched in the future. And then we aim to actually work on conducting research that actually aligns with those priorities. So I just wanted to mention that in case you are interested in hearing any more about that survey that will be being done, please do get in touch. Okay, that is everything that I wanted to say. So thank you so much for coming along and listening. Also, there's a thank you to everyone who helped with this research, including all the participants, the families, as well as organisations like the Dyslexia Guild, so thank you, and all the researchers who were involved. So I really look forward to hearing your questions and thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, that was lovely. I really enjoyed that talk. Has anyone got any questions they would like to ask? Anybody? I can't see any hands up. Yes.
I've got loads. Okay. It might be better afterwards.
Choose one.
So my question is vision. It's not dyslexia.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you've mentioned there is you said macrocephaly and dorsal. Obviously, just might be worth clarifying that the macrocephaly and palpocephaly relate to input, but not the processing components, because both of those channels go to both ventral streams. And I think a lot of the old research didn't realise that. So when you read it, it says, well, the macrocephaly is normal.
Yeah.
But what you really well highlighted is actually the processing components are different.
It's a sort of nuance which I sort of skimmed over because I thought most people wouldn't necessarily know that. But yeah, it's actually a massive oversimplification in the literature that there's this like two different streams and one whole stream is affected in dyslexia. And there have been loads of people actually saying, well, actually, if we want to look at the magnocellular system, then maybe these motion processing tasks aren't even the right tasks to be using, and things like that. So I agree, absolutely.
But
there's like a...
It was fantastic at showing that there are different...
To try and break it down a little bit about where it's happening. Thank you.
So
yeah, be interested to talk more. Thank you.
Anybody else with any questions?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, Adrian.
Hi.
Sorry.
It's a big room.
I was interested in your cutoff that you used for literacy. I've actually got four questions about it. You don't need to answer all of them, but I was interested in why you chose to have the cutoff.
Yeah.
Because you've already got two different cohorts. Why you chose the figure of 89? How many of each group did you actually lose after that cutoff? And do you think the results would have been different if you hadn't had a cutoff?
Great questions. Yeah, so this is also something that came up in review. So I have been working with Maggie Snowling, and so this was actually her advice. So the reason why the cutoff of 89 was because normally you do sort of, I don't know, maybe one or two standard deviations. One standard deviation would be 85, if I'm getting these things right off the top of my head. But what we find is that normally the children with without dyslexia, when we do these kind of studies, they all have an average above 100. So it's kind of reflecting the fact that that's how we get participants. The typically developing children tend to have a much higher average. So it basically ends up being sort of based on previous research, like a standard deviation below the average typically found in these sorts of studies. So that's the reason why. We did lose a few participants. I'd say maybe about five, perhaps, children with dyslexia, maybe a little bit more. And I guess the thinking is that, inconsistencies in how people are diagnosed, and also people will have different experiences after being diagnosed. So some of the children actually who have a dyslexia diagnosis had very high reading and spelling scores. So I guess it was the kind of, we wanted to ensure that we weren't including those children. But I think I've been in circles with who you should include in your studies and kind of what criteria you should use. And I think really the move now is to think less about groups and to think more continuously. So could we just take everyone and just see how like these abilities relate to reading ability in general across the larger population? Because then you're not losing anyone and you're getting a little bit more kind of statistical power. So I think that's the way that things are going in the future. And I probably would do, if it hadn't been sort of set up as a sort of three-group study. Does that help at all?
No, absolutely. Can I also just ask for the autistic group, was there a cutoff or was there an assessment of literacy?
Yes. So we also measured their literacy. And what we did, for some of the analyses where we did a direct comparison in the three groups, we removed anyone who was in the dyslexia group who showed any signs of autism, so based on an autism questionnaire. And we also removed any autistic children who had poor reading and spelling. And then when I've done the kind of comparison, say, just between autism and typically developing children, we sort of statistically controlled for their reading ability whilst we were doing those comparisons. So yeah, we did kind of pay attention to that because a lot of the children did have both. And whether that could be because we were recruiting for a study with both autism and dyslexia, I mean, I was quite surprised by how many did have both diagnoses.
Just want to ask a question.
Kind of changed my mind because what you said later is kind of answered already. So I work a lot with higher ability children.
Mm-hmm.
So children whose sort of average IQ isn't in the 100, 105, but more like in the 130, 150. And so then I wondered how this sort of study would sort of pan out if done with children who do have that higher ability, and therefore their reading scores might be a little bit higher, or might maybe still look as though they're okay.
That's,
and
yeah.
It's
just so tricky, isn't it? Because so we didn't use a sort of discrepancy criteria based on, people just have very different views on this, and I'm very interested to talk to people over lunch about what you think we should do. Because, if I speak to John Stein or Maggie Sterling, I get completely different ideas about how I should be doing it. So we do, I think I'm just going to have a look, we do have children who do have quite high IQs, right? So there's you know, someone with a performance IQ of 141 in there. But you're right, if I haven't included children who would then be sort of low relative to that, like have a discrepancy, because we just had a cutoff. So that's really interesting as to whether there'd be any differences there.
So I just wondered if it's like directly related to particularly low, or if it's actually related to the dyslexic tendencies in general.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I think regardless of how you categorise it, I think it's still only a subset of people who show these differences. But I think, you know, I've said that what I'm really interested in is trying to work out about what is explaining some of this variability, and that could be, I guess, we could be sort of doing something like thinking about the discrepancy and that kind of thing. So that's really interesting to think about for future. So thank you, yeah. I think there was a question, yeah.
Just a minor question. When they're just doing the flow, they've got to visually see right or left. Quite a lot of dyslexic children might not be good at telling right or left.
Yeah, so they were pressing the buttons that were left or right.
They don't know right or left, some get confused, don't they?
Yeah, so they don't have to know right or left. They're just pressing the button that corresponds. So they're just pressing a button, and we kind of just did some sort of practice trials to check that everyone knew what they were doing and they were kind of responding correctly and that kind of thing to check before we went into the main thing. Yeah.
Yes, do.
Is it worth recommending to dyslexic or autistic students or their parents that a referral to a specialist optometrist to have any sort of assistance, help with any visual processing?
I don't feel like I can necessarily advise based on the amount of expertise in this room.
So I've been talking to Jim Gilchrist, who feeds into the SASC guidelines on when to refer to a specialist optometrist. I'm a neurodevelopmental or behavioural optometrist, so that's one group of specialist optometrists, but there are others out there who also do some of this kind of work. And the general recommendation is make sure all children have routine sight tests, because those are free, and they'll pick up major issues. But then those who are still symptomatic or have poor visual performance are the ones that maybe are the ones that you should refer on to specialists.
But it's also worth saying that these kind of are more like higher level kind of visual processing things, which might not necessarily be picked up anyway by someone who's like an optometrist.
I've just got one quick question. Mm-hmm. Given that there's this issue about filtering out information, have you got any plans to look at children with ADHD on this task?
Yeah, so we actually did do an ADHD measure at the same time.
Okay.
And so we could kind of look at how that was related to these abilities. Now, what did we find? It was related to how well they could pick up the information, actually, the ADHD.
Don't want to put you on the spot.
No, so. I'm just trying to remember because, you know, yeah, it's been a while. But, yeah, so we did find that the ADHD definitely is important.
Yeah.
And I would be interested to actually look at a group of children with ADHD as well, like because they have been shown to have differences in how they make decisions. So
exactly. I was seeing that decision-making moment as part of the process is quite significant.
But in terms of the filtering out the noise, I'm not sure that's been looked at in the same way in ADHD in these tasks. So that would be an interesting thing for me to have a think about and look at. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. One more question.
If there's ways to develop motion processing skills and so on, would it be interesting to see how adults perform on the same or similar, maybe not the insect land, but similar sorts of testing to see if, you know, as we develop as humans from, you know, different
people,
whether we actually then have got the skills to
Do you mean adults with dyslexia or just generally?
To replicate the whole assessment of them with adults with dyslexia, see the similarities and differences are the same.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you would have the same results.
Yeah.
In an adult cohort.
So what I have done a study just in general of typical development, looking at children as they get older and then comparing it with an adult group. So we know what happens as people tend to get older is that they tend to be. So young children tend to sort of emphasise accuracy over speed, and then as they get older, they tend to sort of emphasise speed a little bit more, as well as picking up the information better as they get older. So it would be a really interesting thing to ask is in doing that group comparison in adults. You're right. So generally, we have had a preference for looking at children because we think that there could be compensatory strategies that are coming in. But yes, it would be definitely interesting to know, do adults with dyslexia still show difficulties in these kind of tasks or less so? Yeah.
Yep.
Mm.
And movement, and asking people who do the brain training to answer this in various phases and stages.
Mm.
And it's actually really long. You're sitting for half an hour staring at these dots and having to press buttons. I've done it, it's very tedious. But I'm just really interested in what they will find out eventually, because they are asking if you have any learning difficulties.
Mm.
They obviously already know your IQ and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really interested to hear what they find, actually. Yeah, I might ask you for more details on that. Because I think the research that has shown a link between sort of training up motion processing and then reading has been so far from one lab, largely. So I think it does need more replication. And actually, that was an Italian lab. So then we've got the question of, would it also translate to, you know, English readers as well? So, yeah.
I work with university students, and a lot of my sports students are also dyslexic. And I'm wondering, how is it if you've got a visual motion processing issue, you end up being brilliant at sport? Or is it just because there's only a third of them?
Exactly. So that would be so interesting to know, wouldn't it? So is it that those people are just those who do not have a visual motion processing difficulty? Yeah, exactly. Really interesting that. Yeah, I don't know. So yeah, something to research.
What about people on the motorway? Who's got what processing?
Yeah.
Have you ever done a driving test?
And does what I'm doing actually make any difference to driving? So that's something which is like not actually been tested, right? Like, do we find that people who are not so good at these tasks, like with flashing dots on screens, does that actually lead to difficulties with driving? So.
And does playing computer games make you better? Are they good?
Well, apparently so. So some of the research that's been coming out from this Italian lab sort of says that you can train with action games and things, and that actually improves people's reading. It's through the same sort of they propose the same sort of mechanism. So maybe
parents who hold them off the computer games should be making them play more.
Maybe, but I don't feel ready to advise that at this point in time, based on what I think is reasonably thin evidence.
I'm liking your libertarian.
Everybody's questions, isn't it? So thank you so
great.
Much.
Thank
that was
you.
Fascinating.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Kathy.